Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, there is one very important, very dangerous adversary that is perhaps better understood by Robert Spencer than just about anyone. He is an accomplished scholar and author and analyst and commentator, but most especially a man whose courage when it comes to discussing the challenge that we face from what I think of as Sharia supremacism and the jihad that it compels is probably better than just about anyone outside of the Muslim faith, and to be more relied upon than most of the people in that faith who have anything remotely like his knowledge of the subject. Robert has joined us to discuss his newest book, which will be out formally on Tuesday. It can be ordered as we speak. The book's title is The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS. Robert is graciously giving us a full hour of his time to talk about this most important subject, and I couldn't be more pleased, and I think you will find it very, very edifying. Robert Spencer, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Always great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, the pleasure is truly mine, because as I've said to you on many occasions, Robert, I never have a conversation with you when I'm not learning a great deal, and I'm very pleased that we're able to share that with our audience as well. And I thought, for starters, it might be useful to discuss this from a perspective that I don't think I have ever discussed it with you from, namely, how did you get into all this? What was the genesis of your interest in this subject, and how did you come by your very, very considerable expertise on the subject?
Well, Frank, this goes back to actually my very early childhood when I would hear stories that my grandparents would tell about their childhood in the last caliphate, the Ottoman Empire. And they were very positive about it. As a matter of fact, my grandmother and Barack Obama are the two people that I know of who say that the call to prayer is one of the most beautiful sounds that they have ever heard. And they painted a very idyllic and beautiful picture of their lives growing up there, which led me to the inevitable question, why is it that you're here then? Why did you leave? And they said, we were exiled. Why were you exiled? Then they went silent. And this made me very curious and ultimately led me to start to study the history of that region and the area. And that led me in turn to realize that what had happened to them was really all about Islam. I discovered over a period of many years that they were actually given the ultimatum to convert to Islam or to be exiled. And they chose exile. This was under the rubric of Sharia, as the Ottoman Empire in its final days was facing rebellions from the Greek Christian and Armenian Christian population. And under Sharia, that makes them kufar harbi, infidels at war with Islam. And that means that they can lawfully be killed. It was the Armenian genocide that took place in this context, that the Armenians had forfeited their lives by trying to vie for an independent Armenian state. And with the Greeks in the western part of Asia Minor, of what is now Turkey, they had lived there from time immemorial, including my own family, but they were now also kufar harbi, infidels at war with Islam. And because the New York Times and others were walking around in that area more than in the eastern part where the Armenians were, they couldn't kill them as methodically and fanatically as they did the Armenians, although they did kill a considerable number. but they mostly exiled them. And well, that is why I'm here, as also that is what led me to start to study all this. Then, as time goes by, it became a matter of, as of course you well know, matter of national security concern to have people who knew about the motivating ideology behind this threat of jihad and of Sharia. And so that led me to start to consult with various groups in the 90s, one of which asked me to write my first book right after 9/11. And here we are all these years later. This is all I do.
Well, all you do is kind of an understatement. You have, I believe it's 18 books to your credit, Robert Spencer. And what's even more extraordinary is the unbelievably high quality of your work and the insights that you shed, of which this newest book, The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS, is, I know, the most recent example. Robert, give us in the shortest of short form, we'll be spending this full hour talking about different pieces of it, but the trajectory of the story you tell in this newest book starts, of course, with the personal trajectory of the life of Muhammad. And if you could describe that very briefly, because we've got just a couple of minutes, we'll pause for a second and come back in more detail. But there is a very important storyline that is not generally understood, certainly not from the casual reader, if I can say anybody is such a thing, the casual reader of the Quran. But discuss that life of Muhammad as the beginning of this history that you tell so importantly.
Well, the first thing is that Muhammad is considered, called in the Quran, the excellent example for Muslims, and that's understood in an absolute sense, that if Muhammad did it, it's superb, it's excellent, and it's to be imitated. And Muhammad, unfortunately, he led battles. He ordered the massacre of various populations. There were three Jewish tribes in Medina when he moved to Medina, a city in Arabia, and he had two of them massacred, exiled the third, then went to their place of exile and massacred them there. He ordered the assassinations of his enemies, and he called upon his followers to wage war against unbelievers. He embedded these teachings in the Quran and Sunnah, and consequently, the history of Islam and jihad is a relatively unbroken history of violence to this day.
I wanted to back the storyline up just a little bit, because it didn't begin that way, as I understand it. There was a period before Muhammad arrived in Medina, when he was living in the city of Mecca, and I'd be interested in sort of the juxtaposition of his experiences, his teachings, his life in that phase, and then we'll take this quick pause.
Yeah, you're quite right. In Mecca, he taught that the Muslims should be tolerant of the unbelievers and vice versa. Mainly it was that he was asking for tolerance for the Muslims, actually, because they were a tiny minority compared to the non-Muslims and did not have political or military power at that time. But these teachings are in the first part of the Quran. Unfortunately, it's been standard Islamic theology from the time of Muhammad's first biographer, Ibn Ishaq, in the 8th century, to teach that the violent passages from Medina supersede and in some cases abrogate the peaceful passages from the period of Mecca, which has created the impetus for this unbroken 1400 years of conflict.
Perfect place in which we will pause, and we will return with Robert Spencer right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Robert Spencer, a man I'm proud to call a friend as well as a much, much admired colleague. He has written, I would argue, the definitive book on the phenomenon of jihad, the teachings of Muhammad, the practice of Sharia as it has come down to us over the decades. He has, in addition to his brand new book, which we are focusing on today, entitled The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS, a number of others, including among them The Truth About Muhammad, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. So, Robert Spencer, the topic you introduced just before the break is one I want to return to because it's, I think, essentially the genetic code of the challenge that we face today from what Andy McCarthy has persuaded me is best described as Sharia supremacism, the political, military, legal doctrine of Islam, the path, as it's called, that all faithful Muslims are supposed to emulate, as they are the example of the perfect man, the excellent example of Muhammad, namely abrogation. And I want you just to walk us through a little bit, some examples, if you could, of the passages that we often hear from Muslims who impress upon us that theirs is a religion of peace, that they would have us believe are the operative passages, and I personally believe that for many Muslims that is the case, rather than the ones that command jihad and the oppression of people like your grandparents, and for that matter, untold billions of people around the world over history. So what is this phenomenon of abrogation, and how in practice does it work in this faith?
Abrogation came about in the Islamic theology because of passages, quite simply, that contradict one another.
Passages of the Quran, specifically.
Yes, that's right. And so this became apparent quite early on in the development of Islam and caused considerable consternation and embarrassment among the Muslims, such that there came the revelation that is now chapter 2, verse 106 of the Quran. When we abrogate or cause to be forgotten a passage, we will bring one that is just as good or better. And so the idea, very simply, it's a very simple idea in Islamic theology, that if there are two passages that contradict one another, the one that is considered to have been revealed later is the one that supersedes the earlier one. And so in the Quran, we hear, for example, that chapter 109, it says, say to the unbelievers, I do not worship what you worship, and you do not worship what I worship. You're not going to worship what I worship, and I'm not going to worship what you worship. You have your religion, and I have mine. And that's essentially a statement of tolerance, that we leave each other alone. It's a bit grudging, but it's nonetheless tolerant. Now, this is an early Meccan passage. And so in traditional Islamic theology, it's abrogated by all the passages enjoining warfare against unbelievers, slay the infidels wherever you find them, and so on, that we find later in the Medinan passage. And so the problem is that you will often find Muslims quoting that or disingenuously quoting, for example, chapter 5, verse 32, which says that to kill one person is to kill the entire world, kill all of mankind, without going on to say, to read 533, which says that those who wage war against Allah and his messenger should be killed or crucified or have their hands and feet amputated on opposite sides. The idea of abrogation supersedes the peaceful with the violent and consequently has led to so much violence around the world throughout history, as I show in the book. And it is the central idea that makes it clear that Islamic spokesmen in the U.S., when they speak about Islam being a religion of peace, they are being actively misleading because they are quoting passages that they know are abrogated, but not informing the audience of that.
There's so much there that I want to explore with you, Robert. Let me just pick up on one point that helps, I think, clarify why this is so difficult for the average person to understand. When you speak of a passage by the verse numeration, one would think that the smaller the number, the earlier it would appear in the timeline. So that, in other words, following the logic of what you said, the later verses supplant the earlier ones. You simply have to look for the larger number, and then you'll know which are the ones that are governing. That ain't necessarily so, is it?
No, unfortunately, it's almost completely the opposite. The Quran is arranged not in any logical manner. It's not arranged chronologically or thematically. It is arranged roughly, but even this is not consistent, by the longest chapter to the shortest, starting with chapter 2. The first chapter is very short, and then the second chapter is the longest in the book, and the ones down at the end, chapters 100 through 114, are very short also.
And Robert, I've always wanted to ask this question. Why is that? Is that simply because it was just put together like a shuffled deck of cards, or is there some other purpose at work, as you said?
There doesn't seem to be any clear purpose to it. The legend is that the Caliph Uthman, the third successor of Muhammad, in the year 653, got all the people who had memorized parts of the Quran together and codified the book. Why he ordered it in this way has not come down to us, but there really isn't any rhyme or reason to it.
But having said that, whether it was by design or not, the practical effect is to make it more difficult to discern not only the timeline, the chronology of these various verses, but to get the full effect of which of the verses and their injunctions govern the rest, does it not?
Yes, and it may have been that part of the purpose was indeed to conceal the true nature of what was being taught, because very early on in Islam, non-Muslims were actually forbidden to read the Quran. And in the early Islamic domains, particularly in Muslim Spain, some were punished and even killed for reading the Quran. And so it's possible that this was set up as a kind of a roadblock. I think that's actually very likely personally because of the fact that the English translations of the Quran are almost all written with the intent to obfuscate rather than to clarify. And the primary evidence for that is the fact that they're written, many of them are written in pseudo King James Bible English, even though they were written in the 20th century for the most part. They're written as if they were written in the 17th in a language that nobody speaks anymore. And I think this is designed to be an obstacle to comprehension.
Fantastically interesting. Robert, then the question occurs, when you see, for example, in colleges in the United States, a text that is often used, as I understand it, to teach about Islam in your introduction to religion class, for example, is a book entitled The Quran, The Early Verses. What is the effect of that as an introduction to Islam? And more to the point, is this something that is used very deliberately by those who are interested in bringing people to Islam through dawah, I guess as it's called, proselytizing, to sort of not expose them to some of the binding later verses until after they've taken on and accepted, embraced, become willing to follow the early ones?
Oh, yeah. It's perniciously and actively misleading. Absolutely. Because the early verses are more peaceful and the violent passages are, for the most part, contained only in the later verses, you're going to read the Quran, the early verses, and come out with the idea that Islam is a rather uncompromising monotheistic religion, but that ultimately it teaches peace and tolerance.
Just another great Abrahamic faith, in other words.
Yes. So you're given this in college, and you don't have any idea what the actual teachings of Islam are in regard to imposing Sharia upon the infidels by force when necessary.
Yeah. And am I right that there is evidence that some of those who are trying to spread the faith, as they say, are deliberately saying, we won't tell the convert about the later passages until after they have obliged themselves to follow the Prophet Muhammad and Allah?
Oh, yeah, that's very common. I've spoken with converts to Islam. I'm acquainted with a convert to Islam who was once a very prominent convert to Islam and won an award a few years back for his work from Muslim organizations. And he has quietly left Islam, which is why I can't give his name. He has not made any public announcement of the fact that he's left because of Islam's death penalty for leaving the faith. But he told me that he was almost immediately disenchanted. Despite his zealous work at the time for Islam, he was actually astonished when he converted that he found that what he'd been told about Islam being peaceful, and he's a black American, and he was told that it was not racist, and all these things that he was told turned out not to be true.
A bait and switch, as they say.
Absolutely. And he was introduced only after he was in that to the violent passages of the Quran and the teachings of Islam regarding warfare against unbelievers.
Yeah, which is what we're going to turn to after a short pause. Robert Spencer is in the house virtually. He is, among other things, the director of an incredibly important online resource, Jihad Watch. You can find it at jihadwatch.org. He is also a regular contributor, thanks be to God, to PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, as well as the provider of some superb short videos, which appear both at jihadwatch.org and at the Center for Security Policy site, securefreedom.org. Check all of those out, as well as his new book, which I am very pleased to say will be on bookshelves on Tuesday, The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking with Robert Spencer for this full hour. I guarantee you this is likely to be one of the most important hours of listening you will do in your life, simply because the kind of information that Robert has studied and mastered and articulates better than just about anybody is the sort of thing you have a need to know. The purpose of this program is to provide intelligence briefings to those of you who are going to have to contend with these sorts of challenges, are right now, hopefully, and will in the future. It's easier to do early on, and it's late already. Robert Spencer is the author of 18 important books, including a whole series entitled The Infidel's Guide. It is extraordinarily impressive, whether it's about the Islamic State, whether it's about Iran or Islam or the threats to freedom of speech, as well as, of course, this brand new book, The History of Jihad, really required reading, and I commend them all to you. Robert, we've talked a little bit about the way in which you came to learn about and become truly one of the country's preeminent authorities on, certainly in the non-Muslim world, on the nature of Sharia requirements, notably to engage in jihad for the purpose of spreading the dominion of the faith. And when I say faith, I honestly think of it more of a totalitarian ideology, hence the focus on Sharia supremacism, than the practice of, you know, certain pietistic elements that are protected under freedom of religion and are innocuous, you know, how many times you pray, in which direction, what you say, that sort of thing. But it's when it gets into that really supremacist agenda, and including some of its most ominous characteristics vis-a-vis Western civilization, that I think it is something of a very different character and has to be dealt with differently than religion. Let me then ask you, Robert, because we have, in a way, a prism through which to understand all of this that is rapidly evolving, a very dynamic situation in Europe. Would you give us just sort of an overview, as you see it, of Sharia supremacism in the process of taking down Western civilization now in country after country?
Absolutely. As I show in the book, The History of Jihad, the history of this phenomenon for 12 centuries was one of nation states, Islamic nation states, Islamic caliphates, making war against non-Muslim states and conquering and Islamizing them. But then with the fall of the last caliphate, the Ottoman Empire, in 1924, jihad makes a kind of a shift to more stealthy tactics, and tactics that are not dependent upon the initiative of a nation state. And this is because in the absence of a caliph, according to Islamic theology, Sunni Islamic theology, all jihad is defensive. Now, this is really... it's sort of silly to say it's defensive when one realizes that 9/11 is considered defensive in this view. But this, the classic Islamic theology is that when a Muslim land is attacked, then all Muslims are obliged to wage jihad, even if there's no caliph to declare it. And so all jihad has been couched in defensive terms ever since then. And what we have is jihad being waged by Muslims who are not in a position of strength, not coming from a powerful empire like the Abbasid Caliphate or the Ottoman Empire later and so on, but are working sometimes as individuals or sometimes in groups to affect the destabilization of the governments of the non-Muslim states in which they're residing or to which they have emigrated, in order ultimately to bring about the fall of those governments and their replacement with Islamic law. When the Muslims are facing a vastly more powerful foe and there is no caliph to call offensive jihad, then they consider any movement by non-Muslim states in Islamic areas or what are considered to be Islamic areas as a provocation triggering defensive jihad and justifying all this. So in Europe today, there is this mass migration among which the peaceful Muslims are coming in with the and there's an unknowable number of jihadis, I should say, coming in among the peaceful Muslims. And they have the intent of establishing areas where Sharia is the law of the land. They have already succeeded in doing this in many countries in Europe, particularly in Sweden, in Belgium, in France, and in the UK. And those areas are expanding with the rapid expansion of the Muslim population. The laws of the nation state are not recognized. Only Sharia is recognized. And so inevitably, there's going to be conflict if anybody wishes in those countries to defend the traditional ordering of society and the principles upon which the secular state has been founded, then there's going to be conflict in those countries as the Sharia enclaves grow. Ultimately, this jihad has the same goal as the jihad throughout history, to establish Sharia in the land. It's just going about it in a bit more convoluted fashion.
So to put it slightly differently, what we're seeing play out is different forms of jihad than the overtly violent kind that many of us have come to associate with this problem of Sharia supremacism, at least since 9/11. And you've described kind of the demographic jihad, the migration, the Hajj. You've sort of touched on the stealthy or civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood is most famously called it. And there's also, I guess, a kind of financial jihad that is at work in the form of zakat. As you see these, Robert, how important are these nonviolent elements of the jihad, both traditionally and most especially in our time?
Oh, they're extraordinarily important in both, but particularly now when there is no large caliphate, large Islamic empire that can declare jihad against the United States or against the countries of Europe. And instead, the jihad is being carried out by the hijra, as you say, the emigration of the Muslims from the Muslim areas to the non-Muslim areas for the purpose of bringing them into the fold of Islam. This is in accordance with chapter 4, verse 100 of the Quran, which promises great rewards to those who emigrate for the sake of Allah and die in their new land. And this is what's going on in Europe, that many are emigrating for the sake of Allah, and then they are getting massive financial support from the wealthy oil states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the rest, and are using the finances that they are being given to destabilize the countries that they are in. And ultimately, this is the goal, as I say, to bring down the non-Muslim governments and replace them with Sharia governments.
Yeah. And this is done incrementally, that to varying degrees, like the proverbial frog cooking in the pot of water, it isn't as obvious at any given moment as it is as you see it progressing over time. One of the telltales that I find very interesting, Robert, and you were, of course, very prominently involved. We'll come to the United States in the next segment, but in the case of the effort by certain Muslim leaders and community members in New York City to build a mosque complex in close proximity to 9/11, talk a little bit about this practice of sort of demonstrating the supremacy of Sharia over other populations, conquered populations, in effect, by putting in places they revere, churches most notably, mosques and other manifestations of the superiority of Islam.
This is a time-honored practice in Islam. And I think it was the historical ignorance about that that led to a great deal of the opposition to our efforts, because people didn't actually realize that this is something that had ever happened or was happening at ground zero. But as I show in the book, it particularly was virulent in India, with Muslims demolishing literally thousands of Hindu temples and replacing them with mosques. And I show that this was a job one. This was a very important priority for pretty much every Islamic ruler in India, and that India was treated especially harshly in this way because the Quran speaks about churches and synagogues being protected as the places where the name of Allah is mentioned. And this is the one of the bases for the idea that in Islam, that Judaism and Christianity were originally legitimate religions, but were corrupted by the Jews and the Christians. But they went easier on the churches and the synagogues.
The so-called people of the book.
Yes. Now, this is not always the case, because, of course, we know that the Temple Mount, the site of the Jewish temple, there are two, not one, but two mosques on the Temple Mount in order to demonstrate the superiority of Islam to Judaism. And what was once for 1,000 years, the foremost cathedral in the Christian world, the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, was converted to a mosque immediately after the conquest of Constantinople in 1453 because it was considered to be a sign of the victory and superiority of Islam over Christianity. So the mosque at Ground Zero would have definitely been another manifestation of this declaration of supremacism. And this was why it was so offensive and had to be stopped.
Right. Robert, we won't have time to do justice to this, but just very quickly, one of the other things that is being very visibly accomplished in this insinuation of Sharia in Europe is what I think of as the most institutionalized form of misogyny, that is to say, oppression of women. Could you just speak quickly to the role that that plays in Sharia and what it means for Western values of womanhood and how they're treated?
Absolutely, yeah. It is a staple of Sharia that women are inferior to men. The Quran says, chapter 4, verse 34, that men are in charge of women because Allah has made the one superior to the other. And this is something that is runs through Sharia like a golden thread, that the testimony of a woman is half that of a man, which is also in the Quran. The inheritance rights of the sisters are devalued compared to the brothers.
It's such an important topic, and I don't mean to give it short shrift, but we have to pause for a moment. Robert, when we come back, I want to talk about Sharia supremacism in the United States right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our final and, I'm quite confident, particularly important part of our conversation with Robert Spencer, the author of 18 books on various aspects of the phenomenon, the existential threat of our time, I believe, as Ronald Reagan would describe it. He is extraordinarily conversant in the matters about which he is writing and makes them accessible to the rest of us in a way that is absolutely indispensable, whether it's at PJ Media, Front Page Magazine, or any of the books, including the forthcoming History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. And Robert, we have, I think, set the stage for what is, as I say, perhaps the most important conversation, at least to those of us here in the United States, and that is, having grasped, I hope, now what we're up against and the impetus behind it baked into the Quran and the Hadiths, accounts of Muhammad's life and the like, what is going on here at the moment that may not be on a par just yet to what is currently evident in Europe, but seemingly is on pretty much the same trajectory? Give us sort of an assessment of the state of jihad in the United States now.
The chief engine of the jihad in the United States is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood in the United States has made immense headway, of course, in infiltrating into the highest levels of the U.S. government. This is a very controversial point, but it should be noted that a few years back, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann noted that there were, by name, she named them, people from the Muslim Brotherhood at high levels of the Obama administration and called for an investigation. There was never an investigation. She was just denounced as a racist and an Islamophobe, including by John McCain in a shameful display. And that was the end of that.
On the floor of the United States Senate, no less.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's noteworthy that not long after this episode, there was an article in an Egyptian newspaper, and this was during the time when the Muslim Brotherhood was still in power in Egypt in 2012. And the Egyptian newspaper named many of the same people that Bachmann had named and praised them for their efforts in turning the United States around, in the words of the paper, from being an enemy of Islam to being one of the chief propagators of the Islamic agenda around the world. And this, I think, was an apt summation of what happened in the United States, or to the United States, under the Obama administration. And that this is one of the primary ways in which the Islamic agenda is being furthered in the U.S. today. And so we need to get this terrorist designation. The Muslim Brotherhood declared a terrorist organization, such that the Muslim Brotherhood adjuncts in the United States, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Students Associations, and all the rest of them, can be dealt with in the way that they ought to be.
Now, Robert, I'm so glad you brought that up, because there are those who insist that the Muslim Brotherhood cannot meet the test of the designation criteria for being identified as such by the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Treasury, depending on which of the provisions of law you're looking at. Is there any doubt in your mind that it does, in fact, meet those tests?
No doubt whatsoever. The Muslim Brotherhood does engage in violence. It's engaged in violence in Egypt. Hamas, the terror group in Gaza, declares itself to be the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine. And the Muslim Brotherhood has never rejected violence or renounced it. It's not a largely secular organization. As James Clapper has said, its declared goal is the imposition of Sharia. This is a terror group. If that's not a terror group, I don't know what is.
Right. There are those who find convincing, as do I, a text that, as you know, was introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history, known as the Explanatory Memorandum of the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America. Would you describe the provenance of that document, Robert Spencer, and whether you think, as again, I do, and others, I think we both regard highly, as a both clear and authoritative description of the Brotherhood's agenda in this country, and remind us what that is.
Absolutely. This document was discovered during the investigation of the Holy Land Foundation, which was at one time the largest Islamic charity in the United States, was ultimately shut down for funneling the charitable donations to Hamas. And it was written by Muhammad Akram, who was a senior member of the Brotherhood, and was entered into evidence in that trial and accepted by the Justice Department. This is very important, because even recently we have seen claims from quarters on the left saying that this document was only this one man's opinion. That was never the case. The Justice Department took it with utmost seriousness, and rightly so, because for one thing, in intervening years since the early 90s, when it was first written, have made it clear that this is the program that the Islamic groups in the U.S. are following, interfering with counterterror efforts, claiming Islamophobia, trying to establish mosques as bases from which to Islamize these areas surrounding the mosques. The program has been followed essentially to a T. And so the idea that this is some one man's fantasy is the fantasy of the left in itself.
Well, or a deception. And unfortunately, like so much of what's going on at the moment, Robert Spencer, as you understand better than just about anybody, this is a product, as you say, not only of taqiyya, of dissembling for the faith by the Brotherhood and its allies, but also enabled by the left, which works closely with them in what we call the red-green axis. This is, in other words, no conspiracy theory. This is a document that helps identify and expose the conspiracy. And I think what's important to add to what you said, if I may, is this was a document that was written in 1991. That was about, as I understand it, Robert, 25 years or so after the Muslim Brotherhood began operating in the United States. So it was kind of a status report to the Muslim Brotherhood leadership in Egypt. And it has been followed, as you say, in the intervening 27 years faithfully, and gives rise in part to this very real problem that we're having. And I wondered if you might say a word quickly. I think you have not read it. I have not either. But just as evidence of what that transformation entailed, Robert Spencer, could you say a word about what was called Presidential Study Directive 11, promulgated by President Obama?
Well, that was designed to erase every mention of Islam and jihad from counterterror training. And it was followed very scrupulously in the Obama administration, to the degree that the Trump administration is finding it very difficult to restore realism to our approach to this threat. And it is still very difficult to find intelligence officers and law enforcement officials who are willing, much less able, to identify the motivating ideology behind jihad terror. It's become forbidden, and Obama was instrumental at the behest of these Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood-linked organizations in making it so difficult.
Who had gotten access to and enjoyed considerable influence inside his administration. And Robert Spencer, I understood that this also went further and essentially set the predicate for the United States to interpose no objection to, if not actually aid and abet, the overthrow of friendly governments in the Middle East, notably in Egypt and Libya, Tunisia and Syria, that would, relatively friendly, let's be clear, then be replaced by the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that your understanding as well? And could that have been a factor contributing to the so-called Arab Spring with the disastrous repercussions that flowed from it?
Yeah. Under the guise of democracy, under the guise of supporting democratic rule, Obama betrayed friends and betrayed reliable allies and betrayed people who were not friends but were not causing immense mischief in the region, and enabled the Muslim Brotherhood to attempt to take over all of North Africa, as well as aiding the same effort in Syria. And ultimately, this all failed, but it was the Arab Spring was never the democratic movement that it was portrayed as being, and was always a Muslim Brotherhood effort to impose Sharia.
And one in which the United States government at the time was participating as an enabler at the least. We are at the end of our time, my friend, long before we've exhausted the topic, but I thank you so much for your insights today, Robert Spencer, as well as those you have been sharing with the American people and many others around the world for decades. Robert, thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.